Good evening. On behalf of Cambridge in America and the World Affairs Council of Northern California, I'd like to welcome you to tonight's program, The Beijing Consensus, how China's authoritarian model will dominate the 21st century. We're pleased to have with us Dr. Stefan Halper, the director of the Donner Atlantic Studies Program at Cambridge University, to talk about his important new book with that title. My name is Brewer Stone. I'm a trustee of the council, and I'll be your moderator this evening. And as a longtime student of China, I would just like to add that I think this is one of the most interesting and important books on China's role, emerging role in the international system that I've read in a long, long time. A quick word about the council. The World Affairs Council of Northern California provides a forum where leaders of all sectors can join members of the public to engage in dialogue that deepens understanding and becomes the basis of informed action. To learn more about the organization, visit our website at www.itsyourworld.org. If you're unable to attend a program, the World Affairs Council offers two great ways to stay connected. You may either listen to our weekly radio show called It's Your World on Monday evenings on KQED, or visit our website for audio and video recordings of all our past programs. Tonight's program is being recorded for radio, and we thank our audio engineer, Paul Lancour. Now, before we begin, please take a moment to turn off all your cell phones and any other noise-making devices. While you do that, I'd like to take this opportunity to announce some upcoming events. On Monday, May 3rd, Kira Kay and Jason Maloney, co-founders of the Bureau for International Reporting, will be joining us to discuss nations in crisis and how we can halt their slide towards failure. And on Tuesday, May 4th, the Council will welcome renowned economist and environmentalist Paul Collier to discuss how we can better manage resources for global prosperity. Both programs will be held here at the Council Auditorium at 6 p.m. Lastly, I would encourage you all to make use of the blue question cards that have been placed in your seats. Please hand them over to council staff members. Audience question will be posed to our speaker during the second half of the program by yours truly. So it's now my honor to introduce our guest for this evening. Stefan Halper is a senior fellow in the Department of Politics and International Studies at the University of Cambridge, where he directs the Donner Atlantic Studies Program. He's also a senior research fellow at Magdalen College in Cambridge and a distinguished fellow at the Nixon Center in Washington, D.C. Dr. Halper has served four American presidents in the White House and Department of State and is an expert on U.S. foreign policy, national security, China, and Anglo-American relations. Here to offer his insights from his new book, The Beijing Consensus, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcome Dr. Stefan Halper.
Well, thank you very much. That's a lovely introduction, and it's great to be back in San Francisco at the World Affairs Council, where I have actually been before on a previous book. Let me go right to the point here. Why write a book? The answer is that there's a point you wish to make, and in this case, the point is that China is rising more rapidly and in different ways than most people think. And while we focus on the economic and the military dimensions of this challenge, a separate, quite serious threat is found in a different dimension. It is what I've called ideational. There has emerged a battle of ideas about governance. The Chinese have developed a fast growth, stable, market authoritarian model that is admired in the world beyond the West, and particularly among third world nations. It promises regime leaders in Africa and Latin America and elsewhere governance without contentious legislatures or challenging media, and it promises the people employment, housing, and often a better future. Crucially, it does not promise an open public square or the right of assembly, speech, belief, or association. The public is asked to respect the authorities and stay out of politics. The matter becomes more interesting in light of non-Western views of China's example. The words envy and admiration come to mind. With China's rise, a non-Western country now approaches the pinnacle of global power. Even more, the Bank of China, which is now six times the size of the World Bank, is financing infrastructure and energy development across Africa, Latin America, and the Middle East, including to outlier states and pariah states, states nobody else will do business with. With these hard currency loans, China in effect provides a path around the West. In this process, China does not confront the West, but rather has made the West, its standards and its institutions, less relevant. For 30 years, the Chinese have been our economic partners, but they are also our political rivals. Successful market reforms indicate that the Communist Party is not about to crumble, and it is certainly not melting into democracy. What's more, rising China, having survived communism's global demise, has evinced a deliberate self-awareness, in fact, a growing confidence. I see it in my students in Cambridge, who in the last few years are very much more confident than they had previously been. China is not going to become a member of the club, as Roosevelt used to say, offer his hopes about Joe Stalin. China cannot really be housebroken, which some people like to think of. It marches to its own drummer. The market will not lead to democracy, because in China, they have chosen a different path, and proudly so. It is a path that neither confronts the U.S.-led system nor conforms to its worldview. And this has been a continuous pattern building since the Soviet collapse. What do these trends mean for the West? What does this mean in the longer term for the primacy, if not the viability of our values, such as freedom of speech and assembly, transparency, rule of law? And can we expect changes in the values that inform global bodies, such as the UN, or maybe the World Court, or the WTO, the World Trade Organization? Are there going to be changes over the next decade? In 1938, in another uncertain time, a diplomat savant, I'm sure you know who I'm thinking of, George Kennan, said, "Don't ask only how communism has changed Russia, but ask how Russia has changed communism." And so we consider today how China has changed communism further. Before addressing these issues, allow me to say a few very brief words about the military and the economic dimensions of the China challenge. And then I'll return to this main theme. The debate in Washington and in Europe on China's rise focuses on two things. First, it asks if China principally represents a military challenge, and then it asks if economic trends in terms of debt, trade balance, are more important. Some believe these issues are manageable. Others see them as unacceptable threats to global and regional security. So, what do we make of this? Well, first, let's just take a quick look at the military question, and I can give you a kind of sketch of where they are in that realm. The Pentagon estimates that China's total military-related spending in 2008 was about $150 billion, giving China the second largest defense budget in the world. In 2009, military spending rose by 17.4%. Chinese President Hu Jintao said that the military priorities for China were electronic and cyber warfare. Those were the areas they wanted to emphasize. And that includes subsurface warfare, meaning submarine warfare, space-based lasers, and systems that integrate command, control, and communications. in the PLA Air Force, People's Liberation Army Air Force, we've seen China's new airborne early warning and control systems. They employ radar technology one full generation ahead of the United States, the E-3C AWACS and E-2C Hawkeyes, which have been the stable of the U.S. Force, are now in a second sort of position. Beijing claims to have four of these systems in operation. On the ground, the PLA is now introducing tactical unmanned aerial vehicles to support its ground troops. At sea, American analysts believe China may soon challenge the 7th Fleet in the Western Pacific and the 5th Fleet in the Indian Ocean. And indeed, there's been a bit of paint rubbed off the odd warship's bow in each place. China seeks a zone of control off its east coast to include Taiwan, the Spratlys, and the Paracels. And in the Indian Ocean, it is establishing basing facilities. It calls it a string of pearls that run from the Straits of Hormuz to the Malaccan and Sumbawa Straits in the east. Clearly, for Beijing, military modernization is a serious business. Trends paint a grim picture in the Pacific and beyond, leading some people in Washington to believe that a confrontation is a possibility. Yet, for others, like myself, Chinese military development might more accurately be described as a just-in-case capacity to attempt to puncture the American battle space. We're told that China hopes to leapfrog American military hardware with the development of high-tech close-in weapons, which would target U.S. vulnerabilities. What are those? Well, for the most part, communications and intelligence technology. One example, space-based mines. These are mines that are put up in space next to U.S. communications satellites. They can be detonated from the ground, and when they are, they destroy the satellite and therefore interrupt the communication between a headquarters unit and a field unit in a military confrontation. All of that said, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates put China's military in perspective, saying these developments give cause for alarm, cause for concern, but not much more than that, not cause for alarm. So let me turn now to the economic challenge. Aside from the large U.S. debt held by Beijing, there's concern in Washington about the negative trade balance, the artificially low value of the yuan, the Chinese currency, cyber theft, dumping, and the effects of Chinese direct investment in the U.S. economy. That said, China's position as an American creditor is not simple. The large amount of credit Beijing has extended to Washington, in fact, also represents a serious liability for China. A measure of stability is found in what has become a marriage of liabilities, in which China has as much interest in keeping the U.S. economy and the U.S. dollar stable as Americans themselves. Chinese government buys American debt for the simple reason that this sustains the macroeconomic engine that Beijing relies upon. Chinese investment in American bonds keeps the American interest rates low, making credit easier to obtain and generating a pool of capital for Americans to continue buying consumer products, many of which are Chinese consumer products. So that in this sense, American consumers are the lifeblood for China's export economy. Further, Beijing buys American assets to maintain the value of the dollar, which in turn protects the value of its treasury bond investments. Today, roughly $820 billion of China's foreign exchange portfolio is held in liquid U.S. dollar assets such as treasury bonds. If the Chinese government allowed the dollar to fall significantly against the yuan, this would wipe out billions of dollars of value in China's coffers. So, does Beijing have important leverage in this domain? The answer is yes. But Washington has powerful countervailing leverage. The U.S., for example, could limit or threaten to limit U.S. direct investment in China or apply high tariffs that would hit China's export sector very hard, casting people, millions of people, out of work and injecting the prospect of chaos in the eastern cities. on this point, while Treasury has delayed its April 15th report on Chinese currency manipulation, you must make no mistake, China does manipulate its currency. It effectively exports unemployment and prevents others around the world from climbing out of the recession as they otherwise might. So an accounting is overdue, and this is a point which this administration is going to have to answer relatively soon. Bottom line, can Beijing harm the U.S. economy and the U.S. consumer? Yes, but not irreparably, and not nearly as much as the U.S. could, if forced, harm China. A more serious problem arising from China's ownership of American bonds is how this stable system of mutual dependence has weakened America's voice on the global stage. You'll recall Hillary Clinton's trip to Beijing shortly after the administration took office. She told journalists and officials that pressing China on other issues like transparency or Tibet or human rights or those kinds of things could not interfere with addressing the global economic crisis. The same message was conveyed when President Obama visited Beijing, and again in his low-key, no-television meeting with the Dalai Lama in Washington in February. So, here we see an uncomfortable new reality in the way that Washington has perceived its relationship with Beijing. Economic interdependence has blunted America's voice on many of the values and issues that underpin the U.S.-led liberal order, such as progress on the rule of law, free speech, and minority rights. Moreover, certain key assumptions made over the past two decades about China are now proving to be wrong. Contrary to the soothing phrase advanced by World Bank President Robert Zoellick that China is becoming a, quote, stakeholder in the global community, the reality is more complex. China has indeed been very helpful on a range of matters, the North Korean nuclear issue, for example, piracy in the Gulf, where China has put warships out to try to contain the problem, or providing UN peacekeepers, which China has done in large numbers. But beware. A smiling Dr. Jekyll is followed by the iniquitous Mr. Hyde. Why? Why do I say that? Because certain requirements make it impossible for China to embrace Western norms in its dealings with the resource-rich developing world. The problem is rooted in what has been called China's growth trap. China must grow at a minimum of 8% per year. That's the minimum required to provide jobs, housing, and stability to the many recent graduates and rural migrants who come by the millions into the East Coast cities. Failure to achieve this carries the real risk of chaos, which is a nightmare in a country of 1.3 billion. To grow, China must find and secure steady long-term sources of energy, copper, iron, zinc, cobalt, and timber. But China is a latecomer to these markets, and it is spurred by unprecedented demand at home. So China must offer better terms than the established players, which it does in several ways. Let me tell you what they are. First, Beijing uses its $2.4 trillion of hard currency reserves to provide low or no interest long-term loans or grants to resource-rich governments. China can affect these transactions in 3 months, while it can take the World Bank as much as 5 years. It normally commits to road and rail construction to move the resources to a port. It agrees very often to build schools and hospitals that otherwise probably would not be built. And it makes large private payments to chiefs of state to be sure that everything goes smoothly. But most importantly, China pledges non-interference in the internal affairs of these countries. It is not concerned with good governance issues, rule of law, transparency, environmental questions, labor conditions, or the lack or presence of an open public square. China is concerned about one thing: extracting the resource contracted for in an efficient and timely way. China is unconcerned here with Western ethics and norms. It must have the resources needed to grow at 8% to remain stable, because it is a survival issue for the party leadership. And that's the reason that China will not become a stakeholder in the norms and ethics of the global community, as suggested by Mr. Zelik. Over time, the effect of this embrace is to marginalize the principles and values informing Western progress. China is quietly remaking the landscape of international development, economics, community, and by extension, politics. And it is doing so in ways that progressively limit the projection of Western influence beyond the NATO bloc. This process is most pronounced in the Third World, but Second World nations like Egypt and Indonesia, Turkey, and perhaps Brazil have great regional influence. I call them pivot powers, and they are also adopting elements of China's example. In people terms, it means that for those ruled by governments that admire and seek to replicate China's market authoritarian example, the prospects of experiencing democratic civil society are remote, perhaps even non-existent. China is, in effect, catalyst in chief for a profound and far-reaching process. Just as globalization is shrinking the world, so China is shrinking the West. Some 20 years ago, in 1989, Francis Fukuyama told us that we had entered a new era embracing the Western model of free market democracy. But it failed to materialize. Instead, new ideas about capitalism brought wealth without democracy. Put simply, Third World leaders are replacing the free market democratic model with a capitalism that opens the economy to investment and market development and allows the ruling party to control the government, the courts, the military, and the flow of information. Importantly, emerging nations gained wealth as they integrated with the global economy, but this has not meant greater integration with the West. In fact, emerging markets are increasingly turning to each other for business. And there's a very interesting report just out by Goldman Sachs. I know they have a bad name this week. But it says that over the next 5 years, of the 25 largest global corporations, 14 of them will be located in non-Western countries. These developments, new centers of economic autonomy beyond the West, and the growing appeal of illiberal capitalism, are the dual engines for the diffusion of power away from the West. When added to Beijing's continuing currency manipulation, they are the key force multipliers in the global rise of China. Now, there's another side to this equation, which I think is important to mention, and that is that much of China's progress is a function of the failure of the Washington consensus, and that was in the 80s and 90s. Countries across Africa and Latin America were, in the end, many of them, worse off for following the World Bank and the IMF one-size-fits-all prescriptions for growth and modernization. Many were left with stagnant literacy rates, high infant mortality, job loss, and declines in per capita income. As disillusion rose, the door was left open for China to gain traction using policies that adroitly combined the timely provision of hard currency support with non-interference in internal affairs. A very effective combination. China benefited by providing what you might call an exit option for third world governments seeking loans and relief from World Bank and IMF demands for good government reforms. China has utilized these commercial relationships to exert political leverage in international bodies. Creating a group of grateful and compliant acolytes, but not in the Cold War sense. There is no voting bloc within the UN or other global institutions that takes daily instructions from a bloc leader, although Beijing does expect support on Taiwan, Tibet, sovereignty, and human rights when those issues come up. But rather, we see nations loosely connected by an admiration for China, a desire to capture the power of international markets, and an equal desire to remain autonomous from Western concepts of global civic culture and liberal development economics. While there's no Chinese model per se, there are developments and reforms in China over the past 30 years that owe their success to China's unique culture and its demography, its geography, and its governing philosophies, and I might add, the talents of its people. In this sense, there's no model to speak of that can be replicated or exported to places like Latin America or sub-Saharan Africa. But in ideational terms, China is exporting something simpler and indeed more corrosive to Western preeminence. This is the basic idea of market authoritarianism. Beyond everything else that China sells to the world, it functions as the world's largest billboard advertisement for the new alternative of going capitalist and staying autocratic. Thus, Beijing provides the world's most compelling high-speed demonstration of how to liberalize economically without surrendering to liberal politics. Now, let me turn to Washington for a minute, since we all know there's a problem there, and just give you a quick rundown of what it is from the China point of view. While the PRC has coordinated its policies towards the United States through the Prime Minister's office, Wen Jiabao's office, there is no similar mechanism for representing a distilled U.S. national interest. You can't find a similar mechanism in Washington. Instead, China policy is hostage to what you might call Washington's China gangs, where you find a clash of panda huggers and panda bashers. Now, that's a very simple way of putting it, and it's probably misleading in some degree, but generally speaking, there is a kind of a divide like that. Former Secretary of Defense Jim Schlesinger makes the point that the American-China debate is all globulated. He likes that word. And it is indeed a very confusing debate. It consists of a series of interest groups. Business interests, like the U.S.-China Business Council, emphasize China's contribution to global progress. It's the importance of opportunities, business opportunities, and China's contributions to regional security. Then the human rights people criticize China about its treatment of minorities, the Uyghurs and Tibetans. The environmentalists are concerned about China's carbon emissions, the fact that it is a very large carbon problem, 2008. The defense and security people have their own set of issues, and it goes on and on. Labor is worried about working conditions and job loss and so on. This menagerie of competing groups and interests is a luxury we can no longer afford. Instead, to address the new China that I've described to you, Washington has to consider a reorganization that brings the range of China-related issues under one roof, perhaps some sort of expanded office in the National Security Council. It really doesn't matter where it is, so long as it has some measure of authority. And it can prioritize U.S. national interests rather than being whipsawed back and forth by these different interest groups, which range from currency questions to trade to human rights to military questions and so on. The first order of business would be a redefinition of the China challenge and a fresh look at China policy. Allow me to remind you that a half century ago, Roosevelt, who some thought to be endlessly clever but ultimately unwise, that's a quote, tried to gain clarity in a very murky moment. He was driven by gratitude for World War II sacrifice, drawn by the likes of Armand Hammer, the oil magnate, Harry Hopkins, Harry Dexter White. Roosevelt wanted to believe that he could work with the Soviets. The hope, indeed the expectation, was that Moscow would become more like us. The Brits and the French talked about calculated accommodation, and that phrase was the order of the day for a while. Well, George Kennan believed something else. He saw a different pattern. His Moscow experience told him that Soviet nationalism could not both embrace liberal internationalism and survive, and that indeed the prospect of common progress was of another time and place. He took the view that the Soviet challenge was strategic, unmitigated, and that it had to be met. And here we have another murky moment. China arrives in Washington with a soothing scenario, including an expressed willingness not to veto UN sanctions on Iran, and a sotto voce whisper that the value of the yuan may be allowed to rise a little bit. Indeed, China's challenge is very subtle. Unlike the Soviets, China does not want to destroy us. China does not wish to disrupt the relationship we have. We are, after all, the lifeblood of the Chinese economy in many respects in the short and midterm. Yet China's challenge is coming. The battle space is one of ideas, not yet territory per se, like the South China Sea or the North Indian border, but it is the challenge of a building authoritarian form of government, which arises from a fresh type of corporate state that has to be properly defined. So this is a moment of problem definition. And once we do this, we can move on to some of the solutions. Not tonight. Well, I do want to iterate for you the elements of this challenge very quickly before I close. You have a negative trade balance that's grown in 2003 from $43 billion to $450 billion in 2010. That has delivered about $2.4 trillion in hard currency reserves to China. You have a currency undervalued by 20 to 40%, the instrument of a beggar thy neighbor policy that continues to hold global economies in a recessionary, or makes it more difficult for them to escape from recessionary grip. A military modernization, budget increased by 17.4% last year. You have a $6.6 billion global media program to tell China's story in 56 languages, and that's very important because, as Joe Nye at Harvard likes to tell us, it's not whose army wins, it's whose story wins. They have the near total support of 53 African nations, many parts of Latin America and Asia, and these votes are often used to thwart U.S. initiatives or Western initiatives in the UN. But most importantly, the ideational challenge. A market authoritarian form of government, hugely popular in the third world, that has dismissed democracy as plutocracy, mocks the U.S. inability to regulate excess and restore jobs while asserting the superiority of the Chinese example. Now, I have to admit, we deserve that because we made some terrible mistakes in the past few years. But you can see how those mistakes have cycled into a propaganda campaign in which all of a sudden we've become a plutocracy. Well, maybe we are, but I hadn't noticed it. My point is that rising China is not going away. I look at the record over 20 years for signs of democracy or an improved trade balance, or that China is guided by even minimal ethical standards in its dealings with the third world, and I don't see them. Time is not our friend. A top-to-bottom review of U.S.-China relations ought to start now. Washington may not have the unilateral power that it claimed to have after 9/11, but it does have the power and indeed the expectation of others to lead. So I close with the point that I'm not that pessimistic. This is not a fire bell in the night, but it is a warning. Our interests, not to say our viability, are in play. China's ideational challenge does not proceed in a vacuum. Rather, it informs a new generation of leaders beyond the West, international organizations, and global strategists, such that its success will diminish the principles upon which our global standing rests. Maybe we're content with that. Maybe not. But how we deal with this challenge will answer that question. And I thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Halper. We have a number of questions, and I encourage you all to continue sending in more of your blue cards so we can have an active and lively dialogue, and I'll try to enable Dr. Halper to address as many as possible. So first of all, we have a question related to China's appeal in the context of the history of Western-backed efforts to promote development or stave off crisis in the developing world. So the question is, via the IMF and the World Bank and others, so isn't it at least part of China's appeal to developing nations that isn't at least a part of it due to their preference for non-interference instead of the relatively inflexible and at times damaging conditions demanded by the IMF and the World Bank in some of their dealings with the developing world?
You bet. That's exactly right. These third world countries, and particularly their leadership and their elites, are just sick and tired of America and the West and the IMF and the World Bank injecting a set of moral requirements and reforms as conditions for receiving loans. And they're quite happy to have their loans delivered more rapidly and without a lot of discussion. So yes, those two factors are definitely very important. But as I said in my remarks, the Washington consensus has not proven itself as very well intentioned, of course, and it was it had all of the right aspirations, but it turned out to be a one-size-fits-all solution, no matter where a country was, which continent, or what its culture was, or what its problems were. They were talking about reducing the size of government, reducing regulation, freeing up capital, reducing any sort of tariffs, and in the end, any number of industries just simply collapsed because they were so tender and so vulnerable. So the Washington consensus effectively opened the door for China's initiative, and China took the opportunity. There's no mystery about it.
Just to follow up on that a little bit, you cite in your book a lot of really interesting examples of how China basically came in right in the aftermath or in the process of negotiating some IMF or World Bank deals. I'm not to cite any specific ones, but how would you characterize that?
Well, I mean, you had I think one of them was President Wade, wasn't it? They were in the midst of a negotiation with the IMF for a loan, a large loan, several billion. And all of a sudden, they broke off the discussion. Same thing happened, by the way, with Sudan. These countries broke off discussions with the IMF. And there was some puzzlement as to why this happened. But it turned out, not long afterwards, that arrangements had been made with the Bank of China for a loan in the same amount at a lower interest rate and without any of the requirements or discussion about reform. So, yes, there are quite a few examples in the book of how that proceeded, and they are notable. I won't say shocking, but there's something you will take note of.
So we have several questions regarding the effect of China on specific countries. One is, why isn't Hugo Chavez following the China example? And you don't necessarily have to agree with the premise of the question, I suppose. But
well, I don't agree with the premise of the question, because I think in many respects Hugo Chavez is following the Chinese example. He is systematically closing down opposition media. He has affected strong commercial relations with China. He's selling Venezuelan crude to the Chinese, even to the point where, because it's a hard crude, the Chinese have had to build a special refinery in order to turn it into usable fuel. So there is a strong commercial relationship. The Chinese have provided him with internet policemen, instruction on how you manage the internet in order to avoid opposition groups from gathering support or communicating with each other. Not just the internet, by the way, cell phones as well. So China has been very involved with Venezuela. Now, there's an interesting aspect of that, which is that the Chinese don't wish to really annoy Washington over this. And so where Chavez has attempted to draw China in further and further, the Chinese have been very careful about not going too far, as they have also been with Cuba. They're there, but they're not pressing the point, and they don't want a crisis.
So there's a question here regarding the effect of Google on China, and so specifically, what should Google's role be, or what impact would Google having on the attempts to an open exchange of information in China?
Google ought to be hugely applauded for what it's done. It has taken a principled position in a very difficult situation, one in which it's made an investment in a new market, knowing that the consequences of this decision would be to either have a long, protracted conflict with Chinese authorities or perhaps have to leave China. And as it turns out, it looks as if the latter is what's going to happen, and indeed it partly has. They've taken a good deal of their operation to Hong Kong. What Google did was to, and what Yahoo should have done, is to refuse to provide information related to emails or other postings which could implicate dissidents for the Chinese authorities. And what Google effectively said is that they wouldn't be an instrument of Chinese censorship or state control. And I was hopeful that the U.S. government would take a slightly more forward position in at least speaking about the principles which were in play in this event. But they didn't, which is a sad thing. But it goes to my previous point about how the economic relationship has in some ways muted America's voice on critical issues in the U.S.-led liberal international order.
So one of the another question goes to one of the premises of your thesis here, which appears to be that that China is not trending towards democracy. Yeah. Why is China not following the traditional path one would expect of at a certain level of growth you would get a middle class, which leads to different constituencies and so on?
And this is a question, by the way, that comes up every day that I talk to people. We have believed in this country for as long as I can remember, and certainly as long as the history books tell us, that as a market develops, people develop wealth, and as a middle class develops, they develop interests. And those interests are reflected often in terms of factions or politically active interest groups. Factions become political parties, then you've got pluralism, then you have democracy. Well, what the Chinese have done is they're quite happy for the middle class to develop. They understand that as people develop, they will have interests. They have assiduously drawn middle class members into the Communist Party, which, by the way, is not a Marxist-Leninist organization anymore. It is an organization designed to promote connections, and its principal business is staying in business. It's there to perpetuate itself. So middle class rises. They're drawn into the party. Many are not. For those who are not and who do move towards a faction or political expression of their interest, that's where the state comes down. If you were to stand in Tiananmen Square with a sign that says XYZ for president, whatever, you would not be arrested. But if you had a friend who stood in the main square of Shanghai with the same kind of sign, so that the two of you were linked, you would both be arrested. The point is that the state intervenes when it looks as if a movement is getting underway. That's why the Chinese are so upset about this Falun Gong. That's why they monitor the Catholic Church so carefully. And there are other organizations which have pressure.
So another question is, isn't the new capitalist one-party Chinese model just a variant of the Japanese model till 2009 and the Singapore model? Haven't these models actually worked well and created a high standard of living with fewer political rights?
Absolutely. This all started actually in Manchukuo back in the 30s when the Japanese began to create a model which was export-oriented, had high savings rates, and permitted some growth of the middle class. That model was adopted by the Koreans, then by Singapore, Taiwan, and so forth. So you could call it an Asian model. The Chinese have made it an Asian model with Chinese characteristics, as you can imagine. And I've just described why it becomes a very repressive form of government, particularly where political expression is concerned. That's not to say that the model hasn't taken millions of people from extraordinary poverty and moved them into a much more sanitary and, let's say, reasonable life. It has done that, but it has a closed public square, and that's the point that I'm most concerned about.
So a related question is essentially what has been the effect of China's rise and of its rising influence on the developed democracies in regional Asia? Do you think that it's starting to affect them, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, et cetera?
No, I don't think so. I think that those countries are actually rather worried about China and that they're not seduced by the China's model. So the Asian democracies actually are in many ways beginning to work together more clearly on the military side. Japan and India and Australia have evolving military relations. Vietnam is not a democracy but has its differences with China. So I don't see them being affected, except that they have a very narrow line to tread. They don't want to be in the position of attempting to contain China. But on the other hand, they have to insist that the sea lines of communication remain open and that Chinese territorial claims in the Paracel and Spratly Islands, which can be excessive and in violation of international law, that those claims do not close the seaways to commercial traffic. And that's what the Australians and the Japanese and the Indians are most concerned about, and that's one of the principal reasons the U.S. Navy is so important in that part of the world.
So the next question is about China's, to get your views on China's policy of trying to establish multipolar centers of influence in regions around the world, as an antidote, I suppose, to centuries of European and American colonization and empire. Is that a fair characterization of their policy, and what do you think of it?
I would characterize their policy as a 21st century mercantilism. You had the British and the French and the Portuguese pursuing mercantilist policies in Africa, which were designed to extract resources and did nothing for local populations. But those things happened in the 19th century and maybe very early part of the 20th. This is the 21st century. We are all acutely connected with communications. We know what global standards and global ethics are. We understand there's a responsibility we have for people who are in a developing status. But the Chinese do not accept that as part of their, as a priority. So I would characterize their involvement in these places as a mercantilist policy, but not very different from what Europeans did 100 to 150 years ago. But there's a difference, and this is then, that was now. I mean, that was then, this is now.
Yeah. Okay. The question here is, if China's foreign policy is trapped, I think the questioner means is sort of constrained by its political context, is the U.S. also trapped by the political pressures of democracy, taking account of American response to various issues like the Dalai Lama visit Taiwan and so on? How are we constrained?
That's a very interesting question to turn it that way. I think that we are certainly constrained by our values. We express our values. We feel it's important, as you say, to see the Dalai Lama. I guess a very good example of that would be Taiwan. The United States has made a commitment to Taiwan's security and to prevent Taiwan from being taken by force. That commitment is memorialized in the Taiwan Relations Act of 1979. If China were to move on Taiwan, the U.S. would be in a very difficult position. Why do I say it? Well, of course, it's obvious, isn't it? But it's difficult for a number of reasons. One of them is that not to support Taiwan effectively cashiers the value of an American security commitment. It means it's not really worth much, and that's not a good thing. But the second thing is that Taiwan, if you've been there and you know the Taiwanese people, has come to reflect many of the American cultural and social characteristics that you find in many parts of the United States. So there is a link by value and a link by interest. And in that sense, we would be constrained, we would be obligated to support Taiwan, although in the end, it might not be the best strategic step to take, but we'd have to do it.
So the next question is a logical extension of it. How would you change American policy and economic policy and foreign policy in order to limit or affect China's rise? big question.
Well, as I said, I think it's very important that we put all the China issues in one basket and we begin to deal with them in terms of American national priorities. Now, that's really quite important. Secondly, we need to work with our allies, the Indians, the Australians, and others, to draw the Chinese into productive international initiatives. For example, on the environment, what Obama did in Washington on nuclear proliferation was actually rather a good thing because the Chinese came along and at least were part of the discussion. We know that there was very little chance of their signing on to a resolution that would have such teeth that the Iranian government would change its policies. And there are reasons for that, namely huge Chinese investments in Iran. But drawing China into multilateral processes so that its efforts, its influence, its wealth were moving in the same direction as we are is an important thing to do as a general principle. Thirdly, when you have a question like the manipulation of currency, and when you say that you're going to have an April 15th report to Congress on whether, in fact, they are manipulating or not, you need to go ahead and do that. I mean, you simply can't shove it off somewhere and hope it'll go away. It's not going away. We've been talking to the Chinese about this for 7, 8, 10 years. They do allow it to move a little bit, but, you know, they are a major economy. There is no comparable economy that hasn't allowed its currency to float. They're probably 20 to 40% down, and we need to say that if we can't find a way of resolving this, we're going to put tariffs on certain Chinese imports that will level the playing field so that this can be a fair game. We just can't continue to stack up these enormous trade deficits in an unfair process. So I would say that the administration has to have a little bit of a more of a strategic sense of these things. A bit of an iron spine would help.
So next question is about the impact of U.S. corporations. Is U.S. corporate investment in China helping to transform the economy and culture, or to the contrary, is China's response to it, their own policies, for example, emphasis on local innovation, poor intellectual property enforcement, discriminatory purchasing policies, and so on, effectively negating the impact of American corporations to the extent that it's positive?
I think that certainly when you have a large foreign influence in a country, it cannot help but have some social impact on the country and its mores. But to suggest that U.S. corporations are altering China's governance or its corporate behavior is probably a weak contention. What U.S. corporations have found is that their trade secrets somehow are whisked away generally through the partnerships that they form with local Chinese companies. There is no sense of the sanctity of intellectual property. You find it, I was fascinated by an article I saw in the New York Times just this past week, that the Chinese are suffering from a rash of plagiarism in their universities. And the education ministry is saying to the universities, you know, you can't allow this. People are just taking exam papers off the internet. And they're doing it with impunity. And there were some, 1,800 cases or something named, and only 22 cases were prosecuted, including professors and so on. So there's this sense of intellectual property not really being property. And that's very deeply rooted in the society. There, you know, a century or two ago, there was a saying in England that if we could only add 1 inch to the smock of every Chinaman's to every Chinaman's shirt, to every Chinaman's smock, the mills of Leicester would run forever. And that was a time, a simpler time, when they were just trying to sell product. And the issue of intellectual property and other kinds of compromise is probably not quite so acute. Today, it's a different story.
So the next question references your reference to Francis Fukuyama. Have we, in fact, then, per your argument, not reached the end of history? And I suppose you mean it's in the Hegelian sense of the history of ideas. And if not, what history can we expect in the future?
Fukuyama's a nice guy. He's a friend of mine. And I don't mean to say anything ill about him. But I think that was a very rash and cute comment that he made in 1989, which was picked up at the moment of triumphalism and euphoria with the fall of the Soviet Union and its various satellite states. What he was trying to say, I think, is that we'd reached the end of the generation-long Cold War, and now that somehow history could resume. But it didn't come out that way. And we are now back to a much more normal situation in which you have a superpower which is on the global stage attempting to retain its strength and its position. And inevitably, we are being challenged by new powers, in this case China. But that has been the pattern throughout history. The newcomers don't always win, but they don't always lose either. So it is just a question of following this cycle of history through. And I think that it would be presumptuous to sort of name this period. It is a, in my thinking really, it's a return to normalcy. And I'm not saying that in the, you know, the Harding sense. And it's not Wilhelmine Germany either, which a lot of people like to think of as a rising, difficult-to-manage power at the beginning of the 20th. It is a much more nuanced challenge.
So the last question turns this around on us a bit. In your opinion, is the U.S. moving towards a market authoritarian model?
Well, if... I'm not an Obama hater. I'm not suggesting that this government is out of control and gobbling up all of the private and entrepreneurial space in our society. But I think that, I don't think we're moving towards market authoritarian model. We have too many powerful institutions that underpin our pluralism. And we've got a very vocal opposition party. And we've got a powerful regulatory regime. And actually, I have to say, I'm really proud of the way the Senate is now finally beginning to take on the issue of financial regulation and to restore some measure of confidence in the markets. So what we're really seeing is a residual strength in American socio-political system, both socially and politically, that I think it's a good thing for us. We're coming out of the recession, and we're doing things that are important, which other people certainly recognize.
Thank you very much. So we're out of time. Again, I'm Brewer Stone on behalf of the World Affairs Council of Northern California and Cambridge in America. I want to thank very much Stefan Halper for providing his thoughts. He's agreed to sign copies of his books over there, so I encourage you all to take advantage of the opportunity, and thank you again.
Thank you.